The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. TIAA makes you a retirement promise, a promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
Hello, my friend, and welcome to another episode of Negotiate Anything. Thanks for spending time with us today. It's listeners like you in 181 different countries that have made Negotiate Anything the most popular negotiation and conflict resolution podcast in the world. I'm your host, Kwame Christian. I'm a business lawyer, mediator, professor, and the director of the American Negotiation Institute. Before we get started, I have two quick questions for you. Is negotiation a critical part of what you do? Do you need to resolve conflict and persuade at work? If you answered yes to both of those questions, visit our website to learn more about our negotiation workshops. We've traveled the country working with professionals just like you, and we'd love to have the opportunity to work with you too. Check out the link in the description to learn more. Kate, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it is our pleasure. I've been excited for this for quite a bit now. So how would you get us started by telling us a little bit about yourself and what you do?
So I wrote a book called The Good Boss, 9 Ways Every Manager Can Support Women at Work. And it's based on a lot of my own observations over the first couple decades of my career. So I started out in the very male-dominated field of investment banking and worked in finance and mergers and acquisitions first at Goldman Sachs, and then moved over into the education industry and worked my way up, first doing deals and then taking on operating roles, and ultimately became a CEO at the age of 39. I became CEO of the Princeton Review and ran that, tutor.com. And now I'm currently in my CEO role at Presence Learning, which does special education teletherapy for K-12 schools. So I looked back on my own experience working my way up and then running companies. And, you know, throughout, gender has always been a factor for me and something where I've become very attuned to the workplace environment for women and, you know, where it works well, where it, you know, puts up obstacles, and, you know, more than anything, what managers can do, what people with power can do to facilitate a better working experience for women.
That's fantastic. Yes. So let's spend some time talking about the book and let's get deeper into the motivation behind it, and then we can get into the contents. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I wanted to write something. I started out writing a book for young women. And my thinking was, you know, when I became a senior leader, I started getting lots of requests for mentoring from young women who were ambitious and talented and, you know, wanted advice and guidance and help on how to get ahead. And I realized that for me, having female mentors had been really critical. I went to work for a female CEO. She mentored me, designated me as her successor, and ultimately was, you know, a really important part of my career and really key in me getting my first CEO role. But I started thinking about the numbers out there, and only 5% of Fortune 500 CEOs are women, and only a third of all managers are women. So there really aren't enough senior women to mentor all of the young women out there. So I started out thinking, well, I'm going to write a book that, you know, can give advice for everyone who's looking for that mentor and isn't finding them naturally in their own career. When I started doing that and started interviewing other women and asking them about their success and what had really made the difference for them, I came upon something. Almost all of the answers were, you know, not about a strategy or a tactic that they used. It was, you know, I just had a really good boss. I worked for this really great person. This person really made the difference or gave me my big opportunity, you know, and so on. It was always about a good boss. And so that led me to reflect on my own career and say, you know what, that's really true. A boss has a huge impact, for better or for worse, on the experience of a woman or really anyone in their job and in their career. And so, you know, bosses should take responsibility. If there's a way to create a more equitable workforce and a more comfortable, inviting work environment for women, it's going to come from the bosses.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the most interesting things about this book too, because the fact that I think
the assumption for people that don't do their due diligence and investigate, they say, oh, this is a book for women, right? But your target audience is different, right?
Yeah. Yeah, my target audience is managers. It's a manager of one person, or you know, a middle manager or a senior manager. You know, someone could be running an organization with thousands of individuals. And so it is really striking that there's this default assumption that, you know, women help women, and that, you know, when you start talking about opportunities for women in the workplace, you're talking to women as your audience, that it's really women's work, so to speak. And, you know, that again, just looking at the, you know, the numbers of how many managers out there, 2/3 of managers are men, you know, I recognized, well, that's not really who needs to hear this advice, or who I think even really wants it. You know, a lot of the men that I talk to really want to engage, and they want to be better managers, and they want to be more supportive, but they don't always know how. They don't know what makes the difference. And so I wrote this book for all managers, but really with the male manager in mind, to say, you know, hey, this, there are authentic, accessible ways for you to engage in this and to have a real difference.
Yeah, Kate, I really love this, because I don't think enough books are approaching it in this way. In fact, I can't think of any book that's really approaching it in this unique way. So it's a unique approach, and I'm glad that you're blazing the trail. And my hope is that it'll spark more thought leaders to do the same. And I think this is an opportunity as well for us to address negotiation as it relates to women in the workplace, and our scandalous title of why the negotiation advice out there for women is wrong. And I'd love to tie that point in with some of the rules from your book to demonstrate the challenges that exist out there. So let's just start from that premise. Why is the information out there about negotiating for women wrong?
Well, I think that the sort of classic negotiation advice out there is for men. I think that, you know, men are the majority of managers. They're the ones giving this advice. And I think that people naturally, it's a human tendency to, when you give advice, you tell people what worked for you. And what works for men more often than not doesn't work for women. And there's some really, you know, interesting research and data out there about the differences in what women encounter when they negotiate versus what men do. So when men negotiate salaries, you know, they're viewed to be, you know, words like ambitious, aggressive, you know, sort of with positive, you know, thoughts attached to that. Whereas with women, you know, there's this organizational behavior study that found that just the introduction of a negotiation by a woman into the conversation would trigger descriptions about her niceness versus her demandingness. So, you know, the words and associations that people attach to women just for asking, or just for, you know, introducing negotiation as a topic are different. And so when you realize that, it kind of makes sense that the classic advice out there that works for men is not necessarily going to work for women.
Absolutely. And this is perfectly aligned with what I was talking to my last guest about, Zabeen Mirza. I'm not sure when the episodes are going to launch, but hopefully they're close together, because you're approaching this from the same vantage point. And what we've recognized is that when you think about the classic negotiation advice that you, like you described, it's one approach. It's worked for them. That's one thing. And race and gender are very rarely addressed. Mm-hmm. Those two very critical elements of society and the way that we interact with each other in this multicultural world we're in, never addressed. And I think a lot of times it's because the people who are writing the book can't speak to that from their experience. So I think it's really important for us to say, yes, there's a lot of great negotiation content out there, but we have to filter it through the reality that it doesn't work the same way for everybody.
Yep, exactly. And recognize that there's different experiences out there. So there have to be, we either have to change the way that we react to people in the negotiating context, or we need to, you know, reduce the number of situations where people are forced to negotiate for themselves. And I talk about both of those in my book. So one of the rules in my book is, don't make her ask twice. And the premise behind that is that, you know, men are more comfortable not only asking, but asking again. If, you know, if the answer is no the first time, they will come back and ask a second time or a third time, and, you know, continue to self-advocate, to advocate for what it is that they want, whether that's a raise or a promotion or resources and so on. Women are less likely to ask for things. So if you look at salary negotiation, 3 out of 10 women will ask for an increase when negotiating a salary versus slightly over half of all men. So women are less inclined to ask. And so there's a penalty if you, you know, set up situations where, you know, you force a woman to not only ask once, but twice. You know, how likely is it that she's going to feel like she can keep on pushing without getting that label that she's pushy?
This is such a great point. And it's something that I never thought about, but again, it makes so much sense. And when we chatted a couple of weeks ago, you told a really interesting story about how this actually manifests itself in the workplace. Can you share that with the listeners too?
Yeah. So this story is from when I was far younger and earlier in my career, and I was having a lunch with a few executives from my company, including the CFO, and he shared with me a little tip. He said, "You know what I do? I never approve any request the first time someone asks. I always make them ask twice." And, you know, I was sort of wide-eyed, and I was like, well, why? And he's like, "Well, then I know they really want it." So, and I was like, "But what do you mean? So you just ignore the first request?" And he's like, "Well, yeah, if they ask me in person, I tell them I'll get back to you, but I don't. I wait for them to follow up again. Or, you know, if they send me an email, I ignore it and, you know, see if they send it again. And that's how I know, you know, this money is, you know, worth considering spending because it was important enough to them to ask twice." So I took that, you know, with me as I went on in my career, and, you know, however many years later, I was in a situation where I wanted to advocate for a raise for myself. And I had, you know, prepared and had all of my, you know, ideas and rationale and talking points laid out. And, you know, it was not easy to, you know, initiate that conversation with my manager, but I did it. Sat down with my boss and told him I felt I deserved more money, and went through the reasons. And you know, he said, "Okay, I'll think about it. I'll work on it." And then 1 week went by, 2 weeks went by, and I thought, like, well, maybe I'm supposed to ask twice. So I, you know, worked up the courage to go in again and ask him, you know, if he had any updates or any progress. And he got kind of angry with me. He was clearly frustrated and annoyed that I was, you know, bugging him about this. And he's like, "Well, you mean you asked for, you know, that was not insignificant what you asked for. I mean, I can't make that happen overnight." And, you know, it was just, I left the second conversation feeling like, okay, I guess I wasn't supposed to keep asking. And I definitely didn't feel like it would have been welcome to ask again. And that was actually a trigger point for me where I just started looking for another job. And I left the company shortly after that.
Hi, I'm Kevin Konapke, and I'm the Chief Operating Officer here at the American Negotiation Institute. Did you know our company offers completely customizable negotiation workshops? The negotiation and conflict resolution skills that your team will learn from these workshops are beneficial across all professions, but they're especially useful in procurement, purchasing, sales, sourcing, and contract management. Our calendar is filling up quickly, and we even have some workshops scheduled for next year. If you think you might want one, I'd suggest reaching out soon so you don't miss out. Check out the link in the description to learn more. Also, be sure to check out our YouTube, LinkedIn, and Instagram accounts to see our daily negotiation content. Thanks for listening.
The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. In the last 100 years, we've seen financial markets swing, new currencies come and go, decades of savings lost in days, all showing that a retirement plan without a guarantee, quite simply, isn't enough. So more than a retirement plan, TIAA makes you a retirement promise. A promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life. A promise that pays off. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
Hi, I'm Tomer Korn, LinkedIn's Chief Product Officer. On my podcast, Building One, we dive deep into what it takes to build great products. Recently, we had Zach Perret, the CEO of Plaid, and he shared about his struggles building a financial app for consumers and how he was able to turn it all around with a critical pivot. Take a listen.
I personally couldn't resonate as much with the consumer set that we were trying to reach. I just didn't have that level of empathy. When we made the shift to building a B2B product, though, I was building the product that I wanted. My co-founder and I were creating the product that we wanted ourselves, and we had so much empathy for what that product was.
Such a great insight.
You know, in that sense, we got lucky because we were creating a thing for ourselves. And then the people that we were talking to also had the same problems we did. They were fintech developers. We'd been a fintech developer. We'd been trying to build a fintech product for a year. And so we had such deep empathy. We had such a clear ability to...
If you want to hear more of Zach Perret's story and the lessons that follow, listen and subscribe to my podcast, Building One.
Yeah, this is really interesting. There's so many layers in this story that we can explore. I think the first one is going back to the example of the CFO, where he said, listen, I'm going to make people ask twice, because to me, that means that this money is well spent, right? Mm-hmm. That's essentially the idea that he came with. That's a hypothesis. That's an assumption, but it's not necessarily true. We haven't tested that yet, right? Yeah. But a lot of times we're going to fill in our understanding with biases and things that we don't recognize are biases, or misinterpret the data. And so what we could be seeing here, and based on what we've been discussing in this episode, what I believe we're seeing here is the recognition that oftentimes men are not going to be penalized for advocating for themselves. Women, on the other hand, will be penalized for advocating for themselves. And so we're not necessarily seeing a situation where the person who gets the money is going to be a better steward with the money. What we're seeing is that the person who is going to ask the second time recognizes that there are fewer social constraints or penalties for making that second request. And then the person who doesn't make the request is recognizing that there is a cost-benefit analysis that needs to occur. There's a higher likelihood that I will be penalized for my self-advocacy in this situation, so it's not worth the risk. And the person is coming to a conclusion that is not based in reality.
Exactly, because it doesn't recognize the weight. How daunting was it to ask that question? I mean, many, many questions don't get asked because you know, the person has internalized. I mean, you really, that the weight of that builds on you over years if you've felt marginalized in the past, or if you've felt penalized in the past for advocating for yourself. You're going to be, I think, more and more hesitant every time to ask. You're going to know there's a cost to asking, whereas for others, it's easy. Asking, people say, you know, doesn't cost anything to ask, or if you don't ask, the answer is no. I mean, you know, some of those sayings and cliches out there, I think those are really for men. I think that, you know, it does cost something to ask for women.
Absolutely. And this is really interesting to me, because here I'm also looking at the big note that we discussed a lot of times here, where I say, do not ask what women can do about this. And I know listeners are probably saying, Kwame, ask her that question. I want to be clear to the listeners. I am intentionally not asking that question, because we had a discussion about this. And so why is it so important for us to focus on the managers and the culture that has been created in the corporate world versus addressing what women should do, using air quotes for the podcast listeners here, what women should do in these situations?
It's a great question. Thank you for asking. We can't putting the burden on women to adapt. I mean, what is that advice? It's like, well, you know, you won't be rewarded if you don't ask. You should ask. It's, you know, just telling them to do more of the thing that they know, you know, has a cost to them in the current environment is not particularly helpful. It's got to be that person on the receiving end of the request who, as you said, is bringing their own context and their own bias in their interpretation of what's being asked for and how it's being asked for and whether it's, you know, worthy of consideration. It's really incumbent upon that person who's receiving these requests to, you know, moderate themselves and to make it easier to ask, is what I say, or make it so that she doesn't have to ask. Those I think are the two paths for, a responsible manager who wants to really be fair about this. You either really become self-aware about, what assumptions you're imposing on her requests, or you offer before she has to ask. Those are kind of both, and both of those are great. I'm thrilled, whenever anybody does one or the other of those.
Absolutely. Yeah. I love this. If this metaphor doesn't work, we'll just delete it. We'll see where this goes. But I remember when I was I was hearing some people discuss Febreze, right? The air freshener. Mm-hmm. I remember now, it was my mom. We're watching a commercial for Febreze, and people were Febrezing everything. Hey, it smells bad in here. We're going to Febreze it. And now it smells good. And my mom, the Caribbean mother, she's like, why can't they just clean it up? Right? Like, why can you not address the origin of the problem instead of pretending like there's no problem? Let's just spray Febreze and make everybody think that things smell nice, like there's not a mess over there in the corner. And in this situation, there's a mess, right? And there's people who are positioned to clean up the mess, but all of the advice is saying, hey, by the way, here's another bottle of Febreze to try to make the situation better.
Yeah, it's true. Why not eliminate the problem, or why not, act in a way that you don't create it in the first place?
Exactly. Oh, this is fantastic. This is really great. And so before we go, what other rules? Because we have 9 rules. We talked about one, which was don't make her ask twice. When you think about when it comes to self-advocacy for women in the workplace and the changes that need to be made, what is another rule that comes to mind?
Well, another rule in my book that I think really fits here is don't ask, what does your husband do? And that rule is about, there are, again, assumptions that people impose upon women when they get engaged, when they get married, about, what they need. So she doesn't need the money. Her husband has a well-paying job, or she doesn't need to work anymore. These are assumptions that are imposed that then get, factored into negotiations for women, again, based on assumptions rather than reality. I mean, it was pretty amazing when I was doing interviews for this section of the book. I mean, women would tell me that from the minute that they walked into an office with an engagement ring on their finger, people would change their questions, their attitudes, their assumptions about, how ambitious this woman was or what kind of work she wanted to take on. Bonuses would change. I had one woman tell me that she actually is still hiding the fact that she's gotten engaged because she thinks that she gets paid better bonuses when people think that she's, providing for herself instead of, part of a couple that has access to each other's income. So there's a lot of dynamics around that topic of, that's one very specific example of, assuming that a woman is married, has a husband, it really applies to, whatever her family situation is and whatever life partner she has. Just, don't assume that because she's choosing making life decisions or having milestones in her life, like engagement, marriage, children, and so on, that any of that speaks to her ambition for herself and her work.
This is great. Yeah, I'm excited about this. I am really, really happy that you provided and created such a great resource for leaders and managers out there. And so again, before you go, let the listeners know about the book, where they can get it, and again, where they can get in contact with you.
So the book's called The Good Boss, 9 Ways Every Manager Can Support Women at Work, and it's available for sale at all major booksellers. And please pick up a copy wherever you like. And you can also learn more about me and about the book at kateeberlywalker.com and send a message to me there if you want to talk about anything.
Fantastic. Kate, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Congratulations, you've just joined an elite club. By listening to a full episode, you're now officially on the Negotiate Anything team. So welcome aboard. What most team members do is they subscribe to the podcast because that allows them to automatically get the latest episodes of the show. The best things in life lie on the other side of difficult conversations. Keep learning, keep practicing, and keep getting better. Your relationships will improve, your career will soar, and you'll have the confidence you need to get the most out of these crucial conversations. Again, thank you for joining the team. We're excited to have you, and I will see you in the next episode. I'll catch you later.